Welcome to the podcast of Media Matters with Bob McChesney, a weekly show on media from WILL Radio. Visit us at will.uiuc.edu.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. Today, Sunday, January 8th, 2006, our first show in 3 weeks, coming to you live from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign here in truly beautiful Urbana, Illinois, the parking ticket capital of the world. It's a pleasure to be here with you today. We're going to have a great show. We have as our guest today, Kembru McLeod, University of Iowa professor, expert on copyright law and intellectual property, someone who has uniquely made what was once a very dry area of policy, one of the most interesting and entertaining areas of media policy that directly goes to the heart of the future of the media system in this country. So join us today for Media Matters, but first let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
In what appears to be the most blatant violation of U.S. anti-propaganda laws to date, information has surfaced on a secret Pentagon program to use U.S. soldiers returning home from duty in Iraq to sell the occupation there. The program is called Operation Homefront. It includes a direct order to all soldiers returning home from duty to spend time giving interviews with local media. Most importantly, it emphasizes that these interviews should be upbeat and positive, focused only on good news. Troops are prepped to face the media with a long list of talking points which eerily mirror those currently puffed by the Bush administration. One report quotes a reservist who says he's been promised an early release from duty if he does a good job selling the war in the States. Negative coverage is also now being punished. At least two soldiers have been demoted in rank and fined more than $1,000 each for writing honestly about their Iraq experiences on their weblogs.
There's yet another twist to the epidemics of fake news, punditry for hire, and advertainment. Are TV stations using charities as cover to pump their revenues? Many TV stations host charitable events, especially during holiday times, such as toy or clothing drives. These are often sponsored by a business, which pays the station to air promotions about the charity event and receives mentions in local news coverage. The problem is that viewers don't know about the money behind the deal. It's all portrayed simply as corporate altruism. According to FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein, such arrangements may violate FCC prohibitions on payola, and he's asking the agency to open an investigation into the practice. Several similar probes are ongoing at the FCC, although none of them appear to have any real momentum.
Sony BMG's recent trip through public relations hell may be coming to a close. After bloggers broke the news in November that the conglomerate had surreptitiously installed anti-copying software on consumers' computers when they played certain Sony BMG compact discs, and that the software compromised the security of the computers in the process, Sony BMG pulled the discs from circulation and tried to apologize. Not fast enough for several class action lawsuits, the majority of which may be settled through a uniquely ironic proposal from the label. According to the terms of the deal, consumers whose computers were damaged by Sony BMG will be eligible to download replacement copies of the music they purchased free of any digital rights management protection. They may also be eligible to download a bonus album or two of their choice. A New York federal court is expected to approve the settlement this month. However, one class action lawsuit filed by the Attorney General of the state of Texas is still pending. That one accuses Sony BMG of violating a state law prohibiting the sale of spyware.
2005 ended with nary a whimper from the FCC on the indecency front. This after a record-setting year in 2004, where the FCC issued more than $8 million in indecency-related fines. In fact, 2005 was the first time in a dozen years that the FCC has gone through an entire year without taking any enforcement action on indecency.
Liberal bias at National Public Radio? Think again. According to NPR's own ombudsman, in 2005, the network catered much more to conservative experts than it did to liberal ones. A good example of this phenomenon in action is NPR's reliance on speakers from think tanks for its news coverage. Last year, representatives from conservative think tanks made nearly twice as many appearances on NPR than did speakers from liberal research institutes. And now, here's a Media Minutes Fast Fact. 2005 was a dangerous year to be a journalist. According to Reporters Without Borders, 68 news workers were killed on the job, while another 1,300 were physically attacked or threatened. The most dangerous place to practice journalism was Iraq, where 29 news workers died last year. More journalists have now lost their lives in Iraq since the U.S. invasion than were killed in the entire Vietnam War. Meanwhile, press freedom in America remains under attack. The 2005 World Press Freedom Index from the Committee to Protect Journalists ranked 167 countries on their treatment of journalists. The United States placed 44th, just below Macedonia, but just above Bolivia, primarily for eroding journalistic protection of confidential sources. Meanwhile, the U.S. ranks 6th in the world for the number of jailed journalists. Currently, there are 5 foreign journalists behind U.S. bars, 4 in detention facilities in Iraq, and 1 at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. None have been formally charged with any crime. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, from DMWILL, AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. It is January 8th, 2006. We've been gone for a few weeks celebrating the holidays, Christmas and New Year's Day. So it's great to be back live with you on the air. We have a great show for you today. Just a bit of information before we get to today's guest. We have as our producer today, John Anderson, whose voice you hear every week as the producer and one of the co-anchors of the Media Minutes program. He's sitting in very graciously for Andrew O'Boyle, our producer, who's back in his native Ireland. Andrew O'Boyle will be back with us shortly. I think next week we can expect to get Andrew back, and we've missed him and look forward to seeing him. Today's guest on Media Matters is Kimbrew McLeod. Kimbrew McLeod is a journalist, activist, artist, and a professor in the Department of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa. Kimbrew McLeod is the author of 2 books, Owning Culture, Authorship, Ownership, and Intellectual Property Law, and also that came out in 2001, and also a new book, Freedom of Expression, Overzealous Copyright Bozos and Other Enemies of Creativity, published by Doubleday just last year, 2005. Kimbrew McLeod, welcome to Media Matters.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's terrific to have you, Kimbrew. It's a pleasure to have you here. And let's just start off with a few basics for our listeners who might not be real experts in intellectual property and copyright law. What is copyright law and what is its purpose? I mean, what are its origins? What's its purpose? Why? And then after we talk about that, why is it important?
Well, in a nutshell, copyright originates in the United States, although like it drew from principles that came from Europe. And the United States was the first country to write copyright and patent laws into its constitution, actually. And it was the first to pass the laws. And the purpose was quite simply to encourage creativity on both like scientific innovations with patents. Patents cover, inventions and such. And copyrights cover, quote-unquote, creative works, plays, music, films, etc., books, of course. My book is copyrighted, and so are your books. And so the reason why it was written into the Constitution is because the U.S. was a young country and with essentially no real indigenous culture. And it was essentially, most legal scholars argue that it was set up as a kind of bribe, where in the beginning, we bribed authors to have government-protected rights over their works that at the time lasted 7 years, and then it was 14 years, and then it was 28 years. And now it's life of the author plus 70 years. So what we have is a situation, which I write about in the book, is what it essentially started out as something that was meant to encourage creativity and encourage the dissemination of new works. And what I argue and others is that it unfortunately, in many instances, has a censoring effect, stifling effect. So in answering your question, I sort of went beyond the range of your question, but just to draw back rein in a bit. In a nutshell, my answer is copyright is meant to encourage creativity.
Now, Kimberly McLeod, if I understand it, when you said that the Constitution authorizes Congress to set up copyright law and patent law, so a given author, for example, 7 years or 14 years of ownership of their book or their music or whatever, that means they would have monopoly rights over it. And then after that 14 years, after the copyright expires, what happens to that book?
Well, it goes into the public domain. And thanks for following up on that, because that's what I meant by referring to it as a kind of bribe. Because the bribe is we bribe authors to be able to make money or whatever off of their works for a certain amount of time, and then the bribe is so that they will contribute to the public domain. So the works, once their copyrights lapse, go into the public domain, which means that anyone can use it. So if we're talking about Shakespeare play that was written hundreds of years ago, or, a Victor Hugo play that is a novel, like Les Miserables, which ends up getting turned into, you know, a musical, a movie. And anyone can do that. They don't have to ask Victor Hugo's estate to be able to adapt that work. And that's what I mean by the bribe. It's, it's a short-term bribe where authors, we are allowed to make money off of our work. And that's one reason why authors are encouraged to write. Other times, authors are encouraged to write for other reasons, like they're just driven to do so. But the point is they contribute to the public good by eventually giving up their rights. Yes.
So the idea also, outside of other uses of a book, if you didn't have copyright and an author wrote a book, any other company could take the book and publish it and not give the author any royalties. And so under that system, authors would have no incentive to write any books at all because other people would publish them and not compensate them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting because that was going on, let's say, in the 19th century in the United States. That was going on. So because the United States didn't recognize the copyrights of foreign writers. So Charles Dickens, for instance, was really upset about the fact that people were essentially copying his books in the United States, publishers were, and selling them. Although it didn't stop him from writing the books. He was driven to write books for reasons other than financial motives.
Well, his books were covered by copyright in his native England, so
he was handsomely rewarded there.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so eventually, I raise that point only to make the point that now the United States is one of the biggest enforcers of copyright and essentially trying to impose its copyright laws and patent laws with regard to drug patents on the rest of the world, especially developing countries. But the U.S. was a developing country in the 19th century, and we benefited from essentially piggybacking on other countries' cultural works and scientific works. And the irony is that we turn around and want to stop the same thing that we were doing just, 100 years ago.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Kimberly McLeod, professor, journalist, activist, and artist at the Department of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa. McLeod's the author of a couple of books, including the very recent Freedom of Expression, Overzealous Copyright Bozos and Other Enemies of Creativity, published by Doubleday in 2005. Also, Kimberly McLeod is a filmmaker and made the documentary in 2001 on the music industry, Money for Nothing, Beyond the Business of Pop Music. And he's also made the documentary on intellectual property called Copyright Criminals, which came out last year. If you'd like to call in with any questions or comments, the number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Kimberly McLeod, you spoke just now about how the United States used copyright as sort of a developing country to protect its interests and encourage domestic production of culture in the first 100 years or so of the Republic, and that's changed dramatically in the past 50 or 100 years. Talk a little bit more about what copyright has become, how it's changed over the course of the 20th century, now into the digital era.
Yeah, well, I'd say in the past 30 years or so, and I use the 30-year mark because it was roughly the time in which intellectual property exports surpassed manufacturing imports. That is, surpassed manufacturing exports as and I'm talking about U.S. exports. Well, around 30 years ago, the industry woke up to the fact that this is a huge, valuable, and growing industry, the intellectual property industries. And so what we had, what we've had over the past 30 years is an expansion, and I argue an overreaching expansion of what the law protects. And so it's expanded to protect, whether we're talking about copyrights or patents, a growing range of things that were just inconceivable like 50 years ago, such as human genes or, you know, colors can now be trademarked. And copyright, most importantly, sticking with, because you're primarily asking about copyrights, we've had an expansion of the length of protection so that in 1998, we had what's called the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act, or the Bono Act, which I'll just call it that, of 1998, which expanded copyright by another 20 years, so that it's now that copyright has expanded to protect a work for as long as an author lives, plus 70 years. Or if you're a corporation, it now protects it for 95 years. The point is that the reason for this change in the law around that time is it was right on the cusp of when a lot of important, for instance, films in the early 1930s would have gone into the public domain during this decade, the decade we're living in. And so Hollywood was really concerned about that and successfully lobbied Congress to extend copyrights.
Now, how do these copyright laws, when they're extended and changed, do they get a lot of publicity? I mean, these are things that politicians are debating on the campaign trail and that Crossfire is doing shows on. How does this take place? So you studied this.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely not something that is front page news, or at least changes in the copyright law, such as the extension of copyright. 1998, when that happened, you know, editors at newspapers yawned. It just wasn't a very interesting story. And so the way this happens is, and the way it's happened really for the past 100 years, since the 1909 Copyright Act, is that the interested parties, you know, the copyright holders, the industries that benefit from the large revenues generated from copyrights, they get together essentially in back rooms, and they are the ones who actually draft the legislation because really the copyright law is such a technical body of law that goes far beyond the abilities of lawmakers to truly understand the intricacies of it, so that they essentially, almost more than any other kind of legislation, turn it over to the industries who are interested in, you know, profiting. And they have had a very, very strong hand in drafting the language of these copyright laws, whether we're talking about the extension of the period of protection or whatever.
Are there any sort of public interest forces that have had any success during these copyright discussions to try to preserve public domain or fair use or issues like that?
Yeah. In terms of organizations, there are a few different organizations that have taken on a variety of different roles. So, for instance, you have the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is essentially kind of a civil liberties organization that is an organization that protects civil liberties online in the digital realm. And so I'll stick with that as an example. And they've actually been pretty successful in challenging in court some of the most overreaching and most egregious elements of these new copyright laws. And sadly, they haven't been successful in overturning the copyright term extension, the Bono Act of 1998. But in other areas, they have been successful in, for instance, some of the listeners may be familiar with Diebold, which is the voting machine company. It's a company based in Ohio that makes voting machines. And they're highly controversial, partly because their chairman, CEO, in 2004, before the election, said, "I will do anything in my power to ensure Ohio's delivers its electoral votes to George Bush. And he was writing this in a campaign letter as a private citizen to other Republicans. But still, you shouldn't have a voting machine company that, that it seems to be partisan. Well, they ended up using copyright law to try and silence and wipe from the Internet a collection of internal memos that a bunch of students from Swarthmore College, they had successfully acquired and posted on the Internet that showed that there were serious problems, flaws, technical flaws, with the Diebold voting machines. And so Diebold used copyright law to sue them to bring to take that down. They said that, look, these internal memos are copyrighted. And so Electronic Frontier Foundation, the organization I was just talking about, actually came to these students' rescue, and they successfully demonstrated that this was a fair use. It was a this was a fair use of the copyrighted works, and it'll and the courts agreed and decided that, you know, the contents of these memos are far too important because to stamp out, because first and foremost, even though we might live in a commercial culture, we live in a democratic society, and so the free flow of information is more important, especially with regard to voting.
You know, we've talked about Kimberly McLeod, public domain, which is when something is fair game for anyone to use without compensation to the original artist. What the term fair use I've used, too, already in this show without defining. What do we mean by fair use?
Fair use is a statute in the copyright law that allows for you to use, without having to ask for permission or pay the copyright owner, fragments of copyrighted goods for the purposes of, well, educational purposes or news reporting, journalism, or critical commentary or satire. So, for instance, you and I were both university professors, and we used clips, I imagine you would, I certainly do in my classes, from the media as instructional tools. And we might show, like, something from Fox News, for instance, a clip. Well, we don't need to ask for permission from Fox News, nor do we need to pay Fox News to use this in an educational context. Nor would, nor did, in fact, Robert Greenwald, who created the director who did the movie Outfoxed, he used fair use this as a defense against Fox potentially suing him for copyright infringement when he used elements of Fox News broadcast to demonstrate their bias. He included those clips in his documentary, and he didn't ask for permission, nor did he pay. And that sort of activity is protected by the fair use statute.
And this is activity like the public domain that isn't under attack by the copyright owner trying to limit or even eliminate fair use as much as possible.
Yes, unfortunately, what we've seen, especially, again, in this 30-year period that I'm talking about, the past 30 years, a very aggressive attempt to, well, with regard to fair use, scare people away from actually fairly using materials that they would legally be able to use. But it's very easy for copyright owners, such as, let's say, Disney, to send out a cease and desist letter because it doesn't really cost their lawyers much of anything. They send out hundreds of these sorts of letters a year, thousands, just with one company. And so basically they try to use scare tactics even when the law isn't on their side. And this is an example of the way that fair use has been under attack over the past 30 years, especially in the past 10 years. And the same with the public domain. It's been under attack just by the fact that with the passage of the Bunnell Act in 1998, nothing will go into the public domain until 2019, or at least probably until Congress extends copyright yet another time. So there is nothing that has gone in the public domain since 1998, nor will there be anything that goes into the public domain until 2019 because of this law. So that's another example of the way the public domain is under attack.
You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, January 8th, 2006. Our guest, Kimberly McLeod, expert on copyright and intellectual property law, professor in the Department of Communication Studies, filmmaker, journalist, activist, artist. author of the brand new book, Freedom of Expression, Overzealous Copyright Bozos and Other Enemies of Creativity, published by Doubleday in 2005, and an expert also in the music industry. And we're going to talk about that a little bit later in the show. If you'd like to call in and talk with Kimberly McLeod, the number here, 333-9455, toll-free, and the toll-free line is open, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. We have some patient people waiting. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air with Kimberly McLeod.
Professor McLeod, I'm a TA here at UIUC. I'm TAing for a class on identity and culture in transnational context. We taught this face-to-face last semester, and we used video in class. Next semester, we're going online, and the students are dispersed throughout the country, some in other parts of the world. We're interested in showing these same videos, and our institution has institutional license to show it. However, there seems to be some kind of fuzziness in terms of being able to stream these videos online to these students. I wanted to know if you've run across this in the past. And then my other question is, if I can't show the full videos online, what percentage of the video can I use in terms of fair use? And can I just put those online without copyright or a password protection?
Well, with this class, it's a very complicated question you're asking, so I'm going to just be upfront with you and say that I won't be able to satisfy like every element in my answer. But in your class, is it password protected? The students who are going to be dispersed through the states, that is, you know, they can only access that content if they log in through the university account.
We could make it that way.
Yeah. Then, I mean, secondly, I should say I'm not a lawyer,
but you play
so
one on this radio
legal
show.
Advice over the air. But my impression from talking to librarians at the University of Iowa and other administrators throughout the country is that if it's password protected, that is, if students can only access it through, only they can access it and you're not streaming it to everyone in the world, then you're completely fine. You know, so for instance, last semester I taught a class on popular music, and I wanted my students to hear all sorts of different kinds of music that they were reading about. And I was legally able to, you know, I checked with the university, the librarians, and I found out this was possible, to post these MP3s of each individual song, the entire song. And the students were able to download them, and they logged on through a password-protected program. So anyway, that's my brief answer, which was probably too long. And I hope that helps because, the students should not be denied, you know, the full richness of the experience that they would get taking the class face-to-face just because people might be scared about being sued.
One of the things we looked at is the Media Education Foundation has excellent documentaries that our library owns. However, if you go to their site, it says on there that they don't allow for streaming.
Uh-huh.
Does that just something they're throwing in there to keep people from doing something that we are entitled to do, or do we need to honor that?
Oh, well, I don't know. I'm sorry to say, I didn't know that that was a policy of the Media Education Foundation, and again, I'm not a lawyer, so it's a very complicated question asking. So
let's go on to the. Thank you very much, caller.
Can you just answer too, what percentage of a video can we use in terms of fair use?
Lastly, I'm really sorry. I just can't give you a straight answer. You can't even get a straight answer about percentage of fair use, a percentage that one can fairly use of goods from a lawyer. But just I'm going to answer this more generally for the listeners and not specifically answer this exact question, which is fair use a good way, and it's still a squishy definition, but fair use is a use that is fair. You know, that if you're using, if you're not, for instance, replacing the value, if you're not replacing the works in the marketplace, you know, if you're not putting something new out that will squash the value of the old work, and that you're using it for educational purposes or for critical commentary, then it's a fair use. So think of it in those terms, you know. Fair use is a use of a copyrighted work that's fair.
This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Our guest today, Kimberly McLeod, expert on copyright, author of the new book, Freedom of Expression, Overzealous Copyright Bozos and Other Enemies of Creativity, published by Doubleday in 2005. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 2, Urbana, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Kimberly McLeod.
Hi, I have a short question and a big question. And before we even get started, I'd like to know how to contact you further, because I work with Project Gutenberg and would love to talk to you more about copyright.
Oh, sure. Well, you can find my email address on my website, and my name's spelled kemberew.com. I was fortunate enough to be blessed with an unusual first name, so that even in the year 2000, I was able to register my first name as a domain name. So it's just kemberew.com.
All right. My quick question is about the original 7-year copyright. I had never heard of that. I thought it started at 14 and then got doubled.
It was 7 years and then renewable to 14.
That was from 1790?
1790. Mm-hmm.
And how long did that last? So it was 7 plus 7.
Yeah, 7 plus 7. So it actually did start out, it could be as short as 7 years, or it could be as long as 14 years.
When did it go to 14 plus 14?
That was in the early 19th century.
All right, I'll ask you that over the email.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, the big question is, I've noticed that the copyright term gets extended every time that people can copy. Mm-hmm. The original copyright, you know, back to the Statute of Anne and the ones that were proposed before that, were reactionary politics to the Gutenberg Press.
Mm-hmm.
And then the 1831 Copyright Act was reactionary politics to the first high-speed steam printing press from 1830.
Mm-hmm.
And then the 1976 Copyright Act was a reaction to the Xerox machine. And the 1998 Copyright Act was a reaction to the Internet. It seems to me that it's always legal to copy something as long as you can't.
Yes. Also, I would add to that list the 1998 Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which even more so addressed this fear that the Internet engendered, in which more and more people could copy. And so the Digital Millennium Copyright Act even created more restrictions on the way that people can use copyrighted goods.
Right. I started building an electronic library on the Internet in 1971,
mm-hmm.
and so that was severely curtailed in 1976 when the Shakespeare I was working on turned out not to go into the public domain. And then, you know, obviously in 1998, you know, another million books disappear from the public domain.
Mm-hmm.
And my theory is that every time it becomes the fact that the public can get the public domain, that they outlaw what would have been the public domain.
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty accurate statement. And the really sad thing about the 1998 extension is the fact that I'm trying to reach through my memory, and I don't have the exact percentage, but I actually just quickly looked it up. Only 2% of those works that would have gone into the public domain, it had the Bono Act not passed, had the public domain continued to thrive, only 2% of those works still have any sort of value today. So you have this situation where you're locking down this very rich potential public domain, 98% of which just have no commercial value. And so projects such as your own, like Project Gutenberg, become stifled in a very, very significant way because, to put it crudely, you know, Mickey Mouse and Steamboat Willie would have gone into the public domain, because of that fear, you have all these other works that could have been accessed by many people through Project Gutenberg, your project, or just simply, you know, other publishers who might want to put out a printed version of a book that is would have been in the public domain. Now they can't, and that's all at the expense of, you know, or the copyright extension is at the expense of the public domain.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines. We're talking to Kimbrough McLeod today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Kimbrough McLeod, author of the new book, Freedom of Expression, Overzealous Copyright Bozos and Other Enemies of Creativity. Line 3, Champagne, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I'd like you to go in maybe some more detail about the law and copyright laws that regards political speech and artistic expression. And sort of start, preface that by a story, a personal story of running up against this. Back during the Iran-Contra cover-ups, one of the things that came out was, you know, that Ollie North had used some traveler's checks to make some purchases with money that had been raised for the Contras. And so the Christic Institute at the time that was trying to pursue these people I made a creative flyer for them to use in some of their, you know, pushing things out to the public, and I made an image of American Express traveler's check, and I made it very large so that sort of the same way you have to do with law and regarding images of U.S. currency, so it wasn't a problem in that respect, but did use their, you know, the style and color and everything else of the traveler's checks, except I made them into American Excess traveler's checks. I also put Ollie North's face in the, where the Trojan was there, and Ollie's signature and Richard Secord, and even had Ronald Reagan's signature down as chairman. And then on the back, the seal of the CIA with as cocaine importers of America. And then they had their all that non-photo blue underneath the image on with the their then the printing of their main text of how they, you know, would say what the case was. And in fact, actually was denounced by General Secord because he's very upset about this. And then after passing out about 20,000 of these, American Express sent one of these cease and desist letters to the Christic Institute, and they decided not to pursue that, even though I think they would have had a case, you know, in terms of satire and artistic speech, political speech.
Right. Yeah, I mean, so this is yet another example. And, you know, I document, you know, dozens of these in my book, and there are so many, there are hundreds more stories that I left out, stories like this that I hear. Almost every day I get emails from people who tell me these kinds of stories, true stories, and it's just yet another example of how the kind of bullying, or I refer to it as these overzealous copyright bozos, but this kind of copyright bullying can stifle free speech. And again, let me return to this idea that, like, you know, yes, we live in a commercial culture, one that is largely propped up by copyright and, you know, the flows of money that are generated from copyright. But more importantly, we live in a democratic society. And so even the founders, the people who wrote the Constitution, Thomas Jefferson, for instance, they're very insistent on making sure that that copyright law would not, like, stifle free speech. And the reason why fair use was written into the 76 Copyright Act was an expression of that, that political speech, other kinds of free speech, are more important than, you know, protecting one element of a consumer culture.
Kimbrough McLeod, you are also an expert on the music industry. You've done videos, films about it, written about it at length. You know, music sales again suffered in 2005 for the music industry, the big four firms, and the independents, for that matter, that dominate sales of recorded music.
Right.
And, you know, these are among the leading overzealous copyright bozos you talk about in the book who try to use the extension of copyright to impede the use of people taking their product and using it in ways they feel is inappropriate. But also there are recording artists who are adamant about the importance of enforcing very rigorous copyright so their music isn't taken without them being compensated.
Right.
How do you respond to the working musician who says, look, I need very stringent copyright or else people are going to steal my music over the internet and I won't get paid. And, you know, we're not all millionaires out here.
Oh, yeah, that's a very good point. I was going to raise it if you didn't. Because I want to make it clear that I and others like myself, other critics of the direction that copyright have gone, we're not anti-copyright. In fact, far from it. We're just concerned about the overreaching excesses that the law has generated. So, yeah, in response to that question, let me put it this way. I actually looked up in my address book and empirically counted how many of my friends were artists, musicians, writers, and it was over 50%. So I can say that over 50% of my friends make their living and their livelihoods from the kinds of copyrighted works that they generate, or at least they try to. And so I would not want to advocate a position that would hurt just not only just anyone, but also my friends. And I've been a critic of the way the music industry has handled the shift to digital distribution. My criticism isn't that all consumers should simply get, you know, all music for free. Far from it. It's just that we need to come up with a more fair and reasonable system. And it's really sad because the example of Napster is a great example of how the music industry has always been short-sighted and has shot itself in the foot when it comes to new technologies. Because what you had with Napster was you had, as someone once put it, you had about, and Napster, by the way, is was the first major internet file sharing service that allowed people to trade music online around 1999 and 2000. And what you had with Napster is, as someone once said, you had, you know, 18 million kids lined up outside of the mall. And instead of negotiating with Napster to try and turn this into a legitimate service, one in which people could pay, you know, relatively small fees, say $5 a month, and it would generate a tremendous pool of money that could be spread and disseminated to the people who actually work to make their music. And instead of taking those, you know, 18 million kids who are lined up outside of the mall, they decided to burn the mall down. And what we've been seeing since 2000 is kind of the result of that strategy of being really short-sighted about wanting to control every aspect of the way that every bit of their copyrighted goods are used. So you had real quickly with radio. Radio was supposed to kill the music industry because if people heard music for free, people wouldn't go out and buy records. But it turned out that radio turned out in the early 20th century to be a great promotional vehicle because the more people heard music, the more they actually went out and bought the records. And then eventually they came up with a system where also radio stations contributed to this pool of money, and that was then distributed to songwriters, and everything has worked out great. But the current music industry just could never work out a system that worked because, well, first and foremost, they really were short-sighted. They're scared.
We're talking to Kimberly McLeod today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 4, Farina, welcome to Media Matters. You're on the air with Kimberly McLeod.
Hi, Bob. Welcome back. We really missed you over Christmas.
Well, thank you.
That's another great show you got tonight. Welcome, Kembru. And I'd like to ask you a fairly general question. I'm working on a critical documentary, and I'm wondering if I can use either news clips or C-SPAN clips or political talk show clips. And if so, is there a limit, 10 seconds, a minute, whatever? And what about pictures? And if I can't do that, I would put up the person's picture, but could I use a picture from a magazine or just take a picture off the TV? And also, could I play the sound without any pictures, if it's the same speech being given on, like, say, All the News, or if it's a C-SPAN public service, like the Senate hearing or something.
Okay, yeah. So that's another question. I just can't possibly answer all the aspects of it. But let me try and be brief and say yes. Let me backpedal a little bit. It sounded like all of the uses that you were describing, especially if you're using, for instance, C-SPAN, you're showing a clip from C-SPAN in the context of commenting on that clip. That is, you're not just simply replicating, you know, let's say 5 minutes of an NBC broadcast just to enhance the value of your documentary by, just including the 5 minutes and not commenting on it, and you're just simply, you know, NBC would say pirating their broadcast, let's say, of Seinfeld. Let's say you're doing a documentary on Seinfeld. Well, actually, let me just backpedal again and just simply say, again, yes, it sounds like a lot of those uses that you're talking about would be fair uses. And so to just summarize really, really briefly, if you're using a sound clip, an image, or a moving image, and you have people, like interviewees, commenting on, you know, the sorts of things that are going on in that media that you're playing in your documentary, then that seems to me to be the definition of fair use. But in order to keep this relatively short, I want to send you to, do you have a pen?
Yes.
www.centerforsocialmedia.org, all one word. So centerforsocialmedia.org, because they have done a tremendous job. American University law professor Peter Yazzie and the director of the Center for Social Media, Patricia Ofterheide, just about 2 months ago released something that's going to benefit you quite a bit, which is after 2 years of research and talking with documentary makers, they came up with a standard for fair use that gives you pretty clearly stated parameters for what you can probably do, what you can do, and it'll probably be fair use, and what you shouldn't do. And so rather than me continuing to answer that question on the air, I want to send you and others to that site.
Great. Thank you very much, caller.
That's great. But could you just say about time limits?
There is no rule. It's not written to the law time limits, so it's just fuzzy. So getting back to this notion of, to speak more generally, you know, a fair use is a use of a copyrighted work that's fair to the copyright owners.
My name is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters today on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today, Kimbrew McLeod, a professor at the University of Iowa in the Department of Communication Studies and author of the brand new book, Freedom of Expression, Overzealous Copyright Bozos and Other Enemies of Creativity. And before we go back to the phone lines, and we have a full bank of callers, I promise to get to all of them. Kimber, I do want you to explain that you trademarked the expression, freedom of expression, and that's what sort of the catch is for this title of the book.
Right. So the title of the book is actually Freedom of Expression, then R with a circle around it. And it was just, I'd been interested in this topic and concerned with the way in which I had seen how intellectual property laws were being used to censor people. So, like the example of Diebold suing the students for posting the memos. And then the plenty of other examples, such as the American Excess that the caller previously mentioned, in which, yeah, certain critical expressions get stifled. So I thought, well, wouldn't that be a great litmus test to file a document with the U.S. government to see if the U.S. government would confirm what I was afraid was probably true, which is that, yes, in this day and age, one can own even a phrase like freedom of expression.
So you could sue someone for using that term without paying you?
Well, I mean, I never have, and I have actually threatened to sue AT&T, the phone giant, the communications giant, when they used freedom of expression in a full-page ad that was printed in student newspapers throughout the country. I can't remember what the ad was exactly, but, you know, encourage freedom of expression with AT&T or something like that. And so I hired a lawyer to send AT&T a cease and desist letter, not for the purpose of actually suing them, because I just obviously didn't have the money to go up against a corporate giant like AT&T, but to as a kind of media prank or a way of spreading the word that, yes, someone had registered the trademark for freedom of expression.
Did AT&T ever get back to you?
They never got back to me because, unlike myself, who doesn't have the luxury of basically ignoring a cease and desist letter if I got it from a big corporation, this big corporation, AT&T, simply just ignored my letter, and then their PR department actually put out a statement saying that Kimber McLeod is a known prankster and we're not taking him seriously. But that was after, you know, the New York Times and Voice of America and the Chicago Tribune and many other and AP wire services picked up the story. So I made my point, and that was the important thing.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air with known prankster Kimber McLeod.
Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Hi. I have a question about artwork. I'm interested in taking illustrations from a book that was published, I'm going to say originally published in another country.
Mm-hmm.
And it was probably somewhere between 1900 and 1920.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm interested in turning the line drawings from that book into rubber stamps.
Uh-huh.
And then reselling, or rather selling, those rubber stamps. What kind of copyright problem could I run into with that?
That's a good question, because the good news, at least the way you're describing it, is that if it was published, you know, no later than 1922, my understanding is that it's absolutely and definitely in the public domain. It is absolutely and definitely in the public domain. And so I don't see you having any sort of problem with basically taking that public domain line drawing and then transforming it, because that's the purpose of the public domain, to encourage more creativity and to...
Okay.
The only problem I could imagine is if somehow you are working from a digitized version of the line drawing, that is, like, you bought this public domain book as a digital PDF file. Did you do that?
No. I own the book. It's a rare book. So
yeah, I just cannot imagine you having any trouble. But again, just to all the listeners, I'm not a lawyer, nor am I giving out legal advice. But I do, you know, I've studied this stuff for years and years now. And and what you're describing to me is just a simple instance in which you want to use something that's in the public domain, and you have every right to transform it. That's the purpose of the public domain. And getting back to this idea of copyright being a bargain or a kind of bribe in which we bribe authors to eventually contribute to the public good, this is a great example of how, you know, the public benefits from a public domain. Because what you're going to do is you're going to just put out more creativity out there in the world, and that's great.
Okay, and then if another stamp company came along and copied what I had put out, would I have any recourse against them, or no?
You would have, without getting too technical, you wouldn't have much much leverage in winning a copyright case, because you both are drawing from a public domain work.
But if she changed it in any way significantly, then that would be copywritten, correct?
Yeah, so that your transformation of it, and again, I can't get too technical, we don't have much time left, but if you do transform it, you make it your own, then what you've just created is copyrighted. And so that, yes, you would have more power to basically prevent someone from pirating your work if they were just simply copying exactly what you had created and transformed.
I know that the poster and album cover that's so popular for early things from the Grateful Dead was a pen and ink line drawing that was taken directly from an early 19th century book that I own.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know if they had ever given credit to the artist that actually did that or not.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't know anything about that. I apologize.
Well, okay. Thank you very much for calling, caller.
Thank you so much. Very
sure.
Helpful.
Certainly.
You know, Kimberly, we ought to turn this into sort of like an advice show.
Yeah, right.
I may have switched this to media advice.
Right.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line two, Eureka, you're on the air with Kimberly McLeod.
Yes, very interesting program. I, like a lot of others, probably have made many VHS copies audio cassettes and other things like DVD copies with the new recorders and CDs. And I'm wondering, is there any threat to people holding these in a private collection and just using them for their own enjoyment, or maybe just trading back and forth with friends for not for any money? And would there be any threat for keeping them for a long time that you see on the horizon? Thank you.
I don't see any problem with private collections of VHS tapes. However, the problem with the shift from analog to digital, like analog representing VHS tapes, like the tapes, the magnetic tapes, and digital being represented by DVDs, is that this time around, with the introduction of DVDs, the industries have become far more crafty in limiting the ways in which you can reproduce works that have been digitized, for instance, clips from DVD movies. So that, for instance, if Bob and I we wanted to take a clip from a DVD and use it in our classes, even though the purpose of that is fair use, even though the intent that is fair use and is fully protected by conventional copyright law, without getting too technical, that 1998 Digital Millennium Copyright Act actually makes the act of circumventing a copy protection illegal, so that by getting around the copyright protection wall that's on a DVD, we are actually breaking another law, even though we're fairly using a copyrighted work. So that's another example of the ways in which, with the shift from analog to digital, there have been ever more restrictions, even on private uses, like the one that you're talking about. But the old VHS collections, I wouldn't worry about.
Let's go back to the phone lines. We have time for one more caller. Line 3, Champagne, you're on with Kimberly McLeod.
Yes, first, could you repeat the title of your book?
Oh, sure. The title is Freedom of Expression. And the subtitle is Overzealous Copyright Bozos and Other Enemies of Creativity.
How would you characterize Sony BMG as far as that's concerned?
Oh, are you referring to
the music monolith, I would imagine.
Right. And are you referring to the recent controversy surrounding the copy protection on their CDs?
Yes.
Okay, real quickly for the listeners. Bob, how much time do I have?
You've got about 2 minutes at most.
Okay, I'll answer this very quickly, but I wanted to give the listeners background. In December, BMG released, like, Neil Diamond, Celine Dion, a bunch of new releases with this copy protection. And basically the fine print says that when you put it into your computer, it installs basically this software program that it's called a rootkit that's so deeply embedded into your computer that it, the purpose of it is so that it restricts the way in which you can actually listen to the CD that you just bought. But the effect of that is that it opens up anyone who sticks that CD in their computer to hackers and people who make viruses who can exploit this little software program that Sony surreptitiously installs on your computer program when you just simply want to listen to a CD. And so I would characterize that kind of activity as certainly a great example of an overzealous copyright bozo overstepping the bounds and actually violating your privacy by installing software on your computer with really out your permission or knowledge.
And didn't that software screw up everyone's computers?
Well, yeah. So immediately after that software, after the release of that software, the viruses started popping up that exploited that software program. And so anyone who had that program installed on their computer was susceptible, and they just settled a class action lawsuit, in fact, Sony BMG, brought by consumers who had this problem.
Well, Kimberly McLeod, I think we're nearing the end of the trail here on Media Matters. Real briefly, if people are interested in following up on this issue, besides getting your book, Freedom of Expression, what websites would you recommend or sources would you recommend they go to?
Well, to put out a plug for Center for Social Media, anyone who's interested in fair use issues.
Let's just leave it right there. I'm getting the signal that the band's tuning up. They want to get in here and kick me out for Tao Smiley. Kimberly McLeod, I want to thank you for being our guest today.
Thank you.
I'm Bob McChesney. I'll be back in 1 week with another guest. I want to thank John Anderson, the producer today, Brett Polson, the technical director. Have a great week. See you all in 167 hours.